the Sturgis inquiry begins into the death of Dawn Sturgis. Maybe the press will decide it's time to cover it after all, or maybe we'll just hear more about hating Russia. My money is on the latter, I think. But Tim, thanks a lot for coming on, eh?
Thanks so much for having me, Chris.
Well, it's my great pleasure, and please stay tuned after the break. Dorothea Gucciardo, and we're going to I won't say her name that way when we talk in person, and we're going to talk about her time in Gaza. No levity there. Thanks again, Tim.
Okay, thank you, Chris.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio. Well, polio has been detected in water samples taken in half a dozen locations in the Gaza Strip. Friday, Gaza Ministry of Health said highly infectious poliovirus had been identified at six locations in sewage samples collected by UNICEF on June 23rd from Khan Yunis and Deir al-Balah. UNICEF USA blames the ongoing bombardment of the Gaza Strip, which has targeted and destroyed more than two-thirds of the enclave's water and sanitation infrastructure. But Israel's introduction of one of the most feared human pathogens into the genocide struggles today to find press exposure amidst the daily atrocities being committed against the captive population there. Dr. Dorothea Gucciardo is research coordinator for the Starling Center for Just Societies and Technologies at Western University, where she also teaches history. Dorothea, too, volunteers with the GLIA project, serving as its director of development, overseeing capacity building projects in Gaza. She writes her latest project, the Open Gaza Initiative, was, quote, interrupted by Israel's genocidal war on Gaza, shifting much of her focus on organizing and leading medical missions into the besieged Gaza Strip. Welcome to the program, Dorothea.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Dorothea, in our correspondence leading to this interview, you wrote, quote, I was supposed to leave Gaza the day Israel took the border. I witnessed and to an extent experienced the mass displacement from Rafah. Dorothea, what happened and what did you see that day?
Yeah, thanks. So I entered Gaza in April for a limited term mission. And my exit date was May 6th. And as I was leaving our accommodations and actually physically entering the truck with our driver, I received a ping on my WhatsApp from a UN security group advising anyone that was intending to travel to the border to remain in place because there was military activity in the area. So I didn't know what that meant initially. I went back inside. We paid attention to news reports, to Telegram channels that posted pretty contemporaneous updates with regards to military activities. And it became clear that tanks had rolled in, that there was shooting, there was some bombings. And we kind of sat back and thought, all right, well, what does this mean? We were initially told after about a day that from the United Nations that the Israeli military had indicated that there would be a limited military campaign that they anticipated would last 2 to 3 days and then they would pull out. So that was our initial impression of what was happening around May 6th.
Well, and Dorothea, the Rafah border now has been closed. It's been actually utterly destroyed by Israel. What's the significance of this crossing?
That crossing was a lifeline. I mean, really, if you think about it, Gaza has been besieged for almost 20 years, and the occupation has been suffocating Palestinians inside Gaza. What Rafah offered was a straw to let them breathe, and they cut off that access. For humanitarian work, it's proven catastrophic. So initially, medical teams would be entering through Rafah. We would bring in material, medical supplies, medicine. We would bring in healthcare workers, sometimes entire surgical teams, who would enter into Gaza and distribute those medicines, distribute those supplies, and treat patients. We were able to enter pretty regularly. So we would go through the Sinai and into Rafah. It was a chaotic process, make no mistake, but it had become somewhat routine and reliable, which was really important because when you're planning any kind of humanitarian mission, you need to have some measure of reliability so that you know that you can provide services where they're needed most and when they're needed most. Once the Rafah crossing was taken, we were no longer able to bring in those medical personnel in the same numbers that we had been able to bring in before. We weren't able to bring anyone in through Rafah. We were not able anymore to bring in medicines, not able to bring in any more supplies. And so we immediately had to recalculate and recalibrate how we were going to respond to the medical needs in Gaza. We waited for about 4 weeks before there was any real sense of how the shift would happen. The United Nations had been negotiating with Israel to try to either reopen that border or reopen another border for personnel to go in and out. And it was chaotic. It was unpredictable. There were a lot of back and forth conversations, a lot of announcements that needed to be rescinded. And so it was a period of tremendous uncertainty for everyone on the ground.
I've talked to your colleague at the GLIA project in the past, Tarek Loubani, a couple of times, actually, mm-hmm. and doctors that have been in into Gaza since the latest incarnation of the genocide. I introduced you as doctor, but you're not a medical doctor.
No.
But you, of course, you know, you're and you're surrounded by them. Can you give our listeners a sense of what the medical situation is in Gaza, at least when you were there last in April?
Yeah. So I ended up being there between April and June until a new pathway was able to be secured for entry and exit through the Karim Abu Salem crossing, which takes delegates now from Gaza through occupied Palestine into Jordan. And I'm glad that you point out, you know, what the situation was when I was there, because even while I was inside Gaza, every single day, there's this recognition that the Gaza that existed today no longer exists, because the level of destruction is so rapid and so vast that the landscape is constantly changing. And that's really important because the area in which Palestinians are forced to live, right, because they are constantly being displaced, is shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. So when I arrived, we were working and had been working for several months in Rafah, which was supposed to be, as we all know, the designated safe zone. It was supposed to be Biden's red line, right? That there was never going to be a ground invasion. Well, that happened while I was there. I could feel the bombs next to me. I could hear the shelling very close by. And internally displaced people were moving out of Rafah and toward Moasi. And what that meant was not only were there increased injuries from the military activity, it became harder and harder for Palestinians to access basic supplies like food. So we're seeing widespread injuries, burn and blast injuries. We're seeing widespread malnutrition at that time. And we were seeing evidence of Hep A outbreaks within the camps that the internally displaced people were living in. They moved out of Rafah as the Israeli military moved in and the American government rolled over. And as they moved into Moasi and moved more north into Deir al-Bala, those injuries still remained. More and more burn and blast injuries, but also more and more incidences of malnutrition, of hepatitis A. And as you now noted in your opener, evidence of polio in the sewage that is flowing between the camp sites very freely, flowing between these tents. these are the kinds of injuries that we're repeating over and over and over again. Now, I'm not medical, but I did spend some time interviewing Palestinians who were located within the tent encampments and interviewing them within the hospitals themselves. And I met a family of a young girl. She was 7 years old. Their house was bombed in February. Her arm had to be amputated. Her father was killed in this blast. Her brother had a broken leg from that bombing, and the mother had two injured feet. That's also a type of injury, right? These injuries that we're seeing happening to entire families, where they are physically injured and they are emotionally injured. The emotional devastation, the emotional injury, the psychological trauma of this war has yet to be measured, but we're seeing it everywhere. And I think that what we can anticipate seeing is a lot of propaganda coming out from the Israeli side, indicating things like they had supplied, you know, Gaza with 2 million vaccines, without actually indicating what those vaccines were, when they were provided, to who they were given, or anything like that. The reality is they don't have them right now, and they need them right now.
What kind of uptake, Dorothea, would anything provided by Israel, any medical things like these vaccines, what kind of uptake would they have coming from Israel? I mean, I know that if I was Palestinian, I wouldn't trust anything that they say or do or offer.
Yeah, and there's a lot of evidence of that too. So, for example, I can't remember the name of the water company, but there are pipelines of water that are clean, they are drinkable, that are available in Gaza, but Palestinians have a really hard time trusting that water source. So I can fully understand why they would have a really hard time trusting any kind of vaccines or medicines that might be coming in from Israel. But when Israel says or makes claims that it's providing, we kind of have to pick that word apart too, because providing most often means opening the border to, allowing entry of. And then these medicines tend to come from other places, right? Either North America, from Europe, et cetera. So they're not necessarily being provided by Israel. They're just, you know, lifting the gates for a brief moment to allow something in. And to go back to our conversation at the beginning with Rafa, nothing is coming in. You know, the things that we were able to bring in as part of the emergency medical team initiative, it wasn't enough, but it was something. And now there's nothing. You know, we were, you know, one delegate, for example, would bring in maybe 10 suitcases of medicines that were on the essential needs list by the WHO and the Ministry of Health in Gaza. We are now permitted to bring 1 to 2 suitcases, and zero medicine can be included in that. We're completely beholden to COGAT or Israel's rules, because we have to travel through occupied Palestine to get into Gaza now. So it's catastrophic, and really it's a matter of ending this occupation and lifting all the borders to allow aid through, in order to scratch the surface of the needs that are in Gaza right now.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with Dr. Dorothea Gucciardo. She is research coordinator for the Starling Center for Just Societies and Technologies, based out of Western University in Ontario. She also teaches history there, as she mentioned. She's also a volunteer with the GLIA project and serves as its director of development, overseeing capacity building. Her project was the Open Gaza Initiative that you say, Dorothea, that you had to stop because of the genocidal war commenced October 8th by Israel. What is the Open Gaza Initiative, and what were you trying to accomplish and hopefully can accomplish again?
Yeah, so the Open Gaza Initiative was designed, and it still is designed, to, let's say paused instead of stopped, to foster a culture of repair inside Gaza. So initially it was designed to address the blockade. Right, we've just spent a few minutes talking about the lack of access through the borders for medical supplies that's existed for nearly 20 years, that medical supplies simply can't get in. And so the impetus was to create a culture of repair within the Ministry of Health, to take biomedical engineers and to train them in repairing medical devices that existed in Gaza already. So it was essentially a two-stage project. Firstly, was to inventory all of those medical devices because there were warehouses full of them in varying states of operability. And to create a software that was native to Gaza by Palestinians and would be accessible by all the hospitals, almost like a library system of devices. So you could see where something was, what state it was in, and you could check it out, you know, like literally borrow it from wherever it might be and use it if it was able to be operational. The second stage was if it wasn't operational, well, then those biomedical engineers would be trained in things like CNC manufacturing, in 3D printing, to repair those devices and bring them back into operation. The test case for this was an X-ray machine that was not working. It was just sitting there in a corner for several years. We inspected it, investigated why it wasn't working, determined that it was one gear that was preventing the machine from working, 3D printed that gear, and boom, that machine was up and running again. And so we had approached the Ministry of Health over this several months in, I think, about February of last year. And I had a plane ticket to go to Gaza for October 26th to launch the project with them. Everyone was really excited about it. And then, of course, October 8 happened with the attacks into Gaza, and that stopped that project from proceeding. But while I was in Gaza, you know, and talking to directors of hospitals and talking to my friends at the Ministry of Health, everyone still agreed that the project is necessary, and in fact, more necessary now as we think about rebuilding and what Gaza is going to look like once this genocide ends.
Listening to you there, that reminds me of Cuba under embargo for so many years, and the native adaptability, especially if most famously with the 1950s style automobiles. When I visited there a number of years ago now, we did what you were describing. We filled our suitcases with toiletries and, you know, over-the-counter medicines, things like this to take in, things that were behind blockade. When you say that Israel stops even those doctors going in and people like you going in from even carrying personal amounts that are obviously a drop in the ocean compared to the great need, that just sounds pure evil to me. The ICJ, the International Court of Justice, just ruled a couple days ago. Have you followed that ruling, Dorothea? I imagine you have.
Sure. I'm not a legal scholar, so, you know, I don't want to give it a blanket endorsement. But to hear an international body say that this occupation is illegal, to call this a genocide, to say that the you know, there is legitimacy to resistance. Yeah, I think they got these things right. And, you know, I really hope, but don't have much faith in the wider international community, especially those states like Germany, the United States, to adhere to that, or for Israel to adhere to that. You know, I think we're going to see these state actors operating as if it's business as usual. But from what I can see on the ground, from what I'm seeing in the campus protests, from what I'm seeing on the streets, from what I'm hearing, what is happening in Washington as we speak, because Netanyahu is supposed to talk to Congress, the people are pretty united that this needs to stop, the genocide needs to stop, and that Palestine must be free. So I hope that the ICJ ruling gave the impetus and more impetus for more people to come out and to share that, because the more people that come out and keep speaking out and keep protesting, it's going to become harder and harder for these governments to ignore those voices.
Yeah, and indeed, a part of this, not only did the ICJ rule the occupations illegal and much broader than Gaza at that, But it also mentioned and brought into legal question the culpability of nations like Canada that have assisted in the occupation in many different ways. You mentioned that the United States rolled over. I would say that they rolled in at the very beginning, not laying this entirely at the feet of Israel, which receives almost the entirety of its military arsenal from the Americans.
Yeah, sure. I fully agree with that. I think that these states do need to be held accountable for their role. They have been complicit. Justin Trudeau has certainly been complicit in this genocide. His hands are stained red with the blood of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians injured and dead at this point. And I hope sincerely that the ICJ ruling, you know, pushes the needle toward justice. Whether that will happen or not, I'm an historian. I don't know. I don't predict the future, but we can certainly meet 20 years from now and discuss the significance of it then.
Well, some things are predictable. That's for sure. Monday just passed, the University of Victoria shut down. They shut down the camp that had been in the quad there for a couple of months. They threatened people with lawsuits rather than sending in the police, as they had up island at the Northern Ireland University a few days before that. Has there been at your university, at the University of Western Ontario, has there been a camp there as well?
There was a camp there, and that camp was there while I was in Gaza. And it was really interesting to be watching it from afar, with friends in Gaza and talking to them about it and sharing voice notes, you know, with people from that camp. My own kids camped there with my husband while I was away. And my baby became essentially the camp baby and was passed around, I'm told, which I think is really lovely. And you know, from the perspective of people in Gaza, it was really heartwarming. It was motivating. They saw a lot of purpose in what the camps were doing. And, you know, we're really pleased to know that there were young people around the world advocating for them, advocating for a stop to this violence. In the terms of Western, it's pretty clear, Western University, it's pretty clear that the president has put profits over Palestine. But the fight is not over. The camp itself, I believe, is mostly disassembled at this point, because that has been, as you've noted, the trend throughout Canada. A lot of these camps have been forcibly taken down due to legal levers being pulled. But the fight is still there. There's still the push to force and these universities to divest from companies that are complicit in Israeli violence against Palestinians. So I'm optimistic. I think that the push there will shift to different means, but the momentum is still there.
Well, the scale and the terror of what's going on, I think for most people, I've followed this very closely for months now. And for someone like me, I am overwhelmed by it. But I think for a lot of people in Canada that just maybe get their media at the regular suspects or the regularly suspect media, they don't appreciate what's happening there. I'd hate to think that there's such a paucity of moral imagination in this country to understand what is happening there. You speak as a parent. The things that you witness and must be the hardest part, seeing the children and the anguish of parents that are affected there. How, Dorothea, do you convey the extent of what is happening in Gaza to Canadians that are watching the CBC and think, well, you know, it's just those people are always fighting each other or whatever?
Yeah. The children was the hardest part for me personally. It's interesting that you bring this up, because I've spoken to people who, and it became very clear that they did get most of their media from the mainstream news outlets. And, you know, some of the things that I would share with them. So, for example, at a maternity hospital in Rafah, in conversation with the director of the neonatal intensive care unit, he told me about, you know, the most impossible decisions that he had to make because of the scarcity of the resources. You know, that neonatal intensive care unit had two ventilators, and 1 week he had three babies that needed ventilation. It was one child from one family and a set of twins from another family. And he had to decide, you know, which of these babies would live and which of these babies, which one would die. And when I tell that story to people back home, especially to those who are not as immersed in what's happening as maybe you and I are, they're just completely shocked, you know, at the evil of that scenario, to force a medical doctor who has dedicated his life to saving children being forced to make a decision where one of those children would certainly die. It's just, it's sad. And I think, you know, it's important to talk about these moments. And that was just one moment, you know, that is repeating in different variations constantly, daily in Gaza. Who gets this resource? What child has access to that medication and which one does not? You know, which child has an injury that we could conceivably say is survivable, and which child can we just simply not help in this moment? You know, that is happening over and over and over again, and it's just so grossly unfair. And it speaks, I think, to a parent's sense of justice and that nurturing instinct to want to protect, and to hear that these people have to make these decisions, I think hurts them, and it should, and that kind of thing speaks to them. So when I'm talking about Gaza, I'm trying to provide some of those stories to give a sense of intimacy to what's happening with this genocide, because when you're faced with this, you know, mainstream news media broadcast, it's faceless. It's those people. It's othering. They're over there. But when you talk about that newborn that took its last breaths because it didn't have access to a machine to keep it alive, I mean, that brings a different level of awareness for some people. And I think it's important to share those stories.
As terrible as that is for doctors who are trained in triage and have to make difficult decisions, but are also trained on how to deal with it emotionally, psychologically, I think of the film Julia's Choice about a woman who was forced by Nazi guards back in the Nazi era in Germany to choose which of her two children could survive and which wouldn't, and how many parents now in Gaza have to make similar kinds of choices about which of their children will survive and which won't. Dorothea, sadly, we're out of time. Can you reiterate your project work and how people can find out more about what's happening in Gaza?
Sure. So again, I've been volunteering with GLIA, the GLIA project, and we're currently sending in medical delegations into Gaza. We also erected a primary healthcare medical point in Zawada, which is located along the coast that internally displaced Palestinians can access. And we've hired local staff to treat patients, and they're seeing about 600 patients a week. We're paying them all competitive salaries because right now it's really hard for anyone to have access to income in Gaza. So it's really important to us that we're paying our people fair wages. But it's all done by donation. And so if anybody felt so inclined, it would be really wonderful. They could donate toward that project and get more information on our website, glia.org. There are other organizations in Gaza as well, Project Hope, CADIS, for example. These are two groups that we worked closely with while we were there too, or that I did personally, and I know that they're doing some wonderful work if someone was looking for other places to donate. Yeah, and then in terms of accessing information to Gaza, I mean, really, it's everywhere, I just encourage people to keep paying attention. And to keep asking questions, especially of political representatives, about their own complicity in this genocide and demanding a stop to it.
Yes, well, all will out in the end. Dorothea Gucciardo, thanks a lot for coming on the show today. and sharing
your
experience.
Thank you for having me.
Well, my great pleasure. And thanks, too, to Tim Norman over at TimTron2020 on Twitter. Thanks again, Dorothea.
Thank you.
That's all I got for this week. Till the next time. Moscow, Tokyo, New York. Guerrilla Radio is everywhere. Online at guerrilla-radio.com. Everywhere, all the time.